Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. The program's website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programs. I'm Sean Delaney and you can follow the program on Twitter with the handle @InsideEd. One of the most interesting and challenging books I've read on education in the last 12 months is Wasted: Why Education Isn't Educating. The book was written in 2009 by the sociologist and commentator Frank Faraday, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Kent. His website is frankfaraday.com. The book, Wasted, is challenging in the way it questions many of the practices that are integral to our education system today, from parental involvement to multiple intelligences, and from play to circle time and self-esteem education. His ideas are provocative, but underlying them are questions about what teaching is for and the relationship between politics and education. Having read the book, I wanted to find out more about Frank Faraday's views on education, so I travelled to London to interview him. Although he was not writing specifically with Ireland in mind, I'll leave it to you to see if any of his ideas are relevant to education here. I'll bring you the interview over 2 weeks, beginning this week. Next week, Frank will discuss the place of authority in society and in education. But in this week's interview, I began by asking him to outline, from his perspective, the purpose of education.
I think the purpose of education for a society is to, first of all, ensure that the intellectual legacy of that society is communicated to its young people, that people are provided with the moral and intellectual resources to make their way in the world and to gain independence and to be able to play the role of acting citizens who can make choices about their lives, both politically and in other kinds of respects. And I think what education is also about is creating the conditions where people have the knowledge and the intellectual disposition to transform and to transform their circumstances, but also to develop a future orientation that is based upon sort of carefully worked out values. But I think at the end of the day, it seems to me that what we ought to be doing as teachers is educating young people to be free.
What you're describing there sound like a lot of dispositions, and you haven't said too much, I think, about what people need to know as a result of going through the education system.
Well, I think the dispositions are based upon the fact that people have learned a variety of disciplines and have, through the process of learning those disciplines, have gained the ability to conceptualize, to abstract, to have a clarity about, you know, what the English language is about, what history is really all about, but the inner intellectual content of a variety of subjects, which they will need as a foundation for their own independence. And I think that seems to me to be the key thing. One of the things that schools can do that nobody else can do is to teach people precisely those abstract, theoretical, conceptual ideas which do not come out of children's everyday experience.
How well do you think our schools today are doing what you think they should set out to do?
There are different kinds of schools with different strengths and weaknesses, and I've seen some really excellent work being done in some schools with some very powerful, authoritative teachers. But I think the overall pedagogy culture of our time is very risk-averse and is one that tends to downgrade the intellectual knowledge content of education at the expense of basically motivating children, at the expense of trying to get children to be interested in whatever is happening in that school by being focused on young people's more external problems to do with, you know, sort of everyday life, their values. We're very concerned about their psychological state. You know, we're very concerned about things that we as adults are concerned about, and we would like the schools to sort out for us. And by doing that, we erode the line between schools and the rest of the world. In fact, even celebrate the fact that the school and the community are the same. And because of that, we tend to ignore or in a sense, push to side what a school ought to be doing.
I think some people would be surprised when you are almost criticizing the idea of motivation of learners, that that is something that schools should have to do.
Well, I think what has happened is that over the last century, increasingly the focus of pedagogy has moved away from the content of the subject that teachers should be teaching towards much more generic issues, one of which is motivation. And I think one of the problems with the focus on motivation is that once you kind of become so focused on motivating people, it's very easy to lose sight of the fact that there is something really important that you want to motivate young people to learn. Motivation becomes more important than what it is that you're motivating them to do. And once you begin to go down that line, then it alters the content of what you're teaching, because you will say, well, oh, my students find history really boring, therefore let's make history, really fun. And you end up teaching a kind of history that is a caricature of what the discipline is. And you will say to yourself, oh, these novels are 19th century with very big words. They're not motivating my students. Therefore, why don't we find something, some comic books or some more relevant writer? And the word relevant is always used to motivate people. And because children will be much more motivated by reading books that are about themselves or about their own community. And therefore, you give up on the idea of young people learning about their literary heritage, about learning about various genres of literature that are part of their culture, that really intellectually stretch them and potentially transform them. And you end up, the next step in motivation is the education of relevance, where what counts as good practice is that this curriculum is relevant to students. And you end up with a situation as in America, where you tell publishers not to produce books about mountains to kids living in cities because mountains are not relevant to their lives. And you end up in a situation where you actually forget that what school should be doing, a really good school should be doing, is actually teaching subjects that are totally irrelevant to those children, because it's these faraway subjects like the history of classic Greece or learning about the laws of physics that get children to get outside of themselves and to think conceptually, to understand the contrast between different ways of lives. And as a result of that, gain the perspective to know how to compare and to select and all those other things that we want them to do. So motivation invariably leads to the devaluation of education, and ultimately it kind of erodes its intellectual content.
And yet, one of the reasons behind motivation is for making students want to learn something. And surely that aspiration in itself, where they actually want to learn about mountains if they're in a city, is a good thing if you can actually get them to do that.
Well, it seems to me that the starting point of this discussion is the question, why is it that we have a motivational problem? Is it the case that young kids at the age of 6 go to school and they say, oh, I want to be ignorant, I don't want to learn? Is it the case that there's something inherent in their personality or in their family background that militates against the excitement that comes from engaging with new information, new problems, new phenomenon? I think very often it's our own attitude. Very often we create obstacles and almost right from the very beginning, instead of trying to kind of provoke and to inspire and to challenge and to stretch, particularly stretch children intellectually. In primary education, we often end up playing with them. We think that they're not ready yet, that we have to wait until somehow this mystical motivation begins to kick in. Whereas in the real world, people become really motivated by what they read or what they hear from a teacher or the way a particular subject, a lesson, is presented to them. And therefore, motivation is not unimportant, but it's going to be organic to what you're teaching rather than something that precedes it or is separate from it.
One of the justifications that's given sometimes for letting students play in school is that they can experiment with different roles. So, for example, they may act as a role of a doctor, or they may act in a role maybe where it might be risky to have a real experience. Maybe, say, for example, if a pet has died or something like that, which is preparing them for other experiences. Why do you have a difficulty with play in primary school?
The reason why I have difficulty with play in primary school is because I know children, and one of the things that children are really brilliant at anyway is playing. They don't need you and me or some individual with a PhD in psychology to teach them, you know, role playing. Because if you ever watch kids, you know, they can play doctors and nurses, you know, without your intervention. They can, you know, they do that all the time anyway. That's part and parcel of the peer interaction that we see in a variety of settings. When children come to school, we can make choices and we can say either we not play, but of course it's no longer play anymore in the real sense, because it's an adult initiated sort of intervention as a way of trying to create the atmosphere of play for the purposes of something else. Therefore, there's a kind of element of bad faith and dishonesty in the whole kind of project. But I think what also happens is that it's as people like Pierre Bourdieu and others have argued, it's a very dishonest way. It's what we call a hidden curriculum, where you don't really, you know, make explicit to children what you're doing, but instead you're trying to control them by these kinds of different kind of psychological techniques. And it seems to me probably the worst example of this, which is very prevalent in all primary education, is circle time, where you know, you have a situation where, you know, kids are sitting around, and teachers tell them to share stories and tell them, you know, what is good and bad about their lives, and the teacher will use terms like, you know, you don't all have to talk if you don't want to. But in the very communication of the idea that you don't have to talk, there's an implication that you better talk, and it's just a more kind of indirect way of trying to kind of control and maybe even motivate children. But all the time you're doing this, you're wasting precious time where you could get kids to develop a love of reading or a love of mathematics or a love of art. It doesn't really matter what it is, just by getting them to do that kind of stuff.
But in circle time, are they not getting to learn how to express themselves and how to listen to other people and how to, you know, engage in discourse with their peers?
Well, I think what they're learning is a discourse and a narrative that is initiated by the person that's running that circle time. And, you know, what they're learning is a narrative, an adult narrative of what communication really ought to be. It seems to me that children are often very good at communicating with each other. If you ever watch children communicating to each other when there's no adult around, it's always very different than when an adult is around. The way kids behave in those two settings is very, very different. And it seems to me that I would rather that children learned these kinds of interactions in a setting that's more organically related to experience than in a psychologically organized kind of framework. See, there used to be a time in the old days when the way that teachers try to control you or discipline you is by criticizing you for what you did, and you could be disciplined or punished or questioned or criticized because of your action. And I think that's fine. I think once you have circle time and the whole psychological orientation that's associated with it, what teachers become interested is not what you do, but how you feel. And once you begin to go into this domain of feelings, you have two problems. One is that, you know, sort of, I think it's inappropriate, because I don't think it's the job of teachers to colonize the internal life world of children. I don't think, you know, secondly, I also don't think that teachers are necessarily trained well enough to do this in a way that is particularly productive for anybody. And what you end up, in a sense, is getting children to feel, in general, more fragile and more self-conscious about their problems, rather than becoming stronger and more independent. And that's really why what you have in education is a history where ever since the beginning of self-esteem education to the present, the more we go down that road, the greater the psychological problems. You would think that after 40, 50, 60 years of doing this in particularly American schools, that things would get better now, because we do. But instead of getting better, the more we do it, the greater the mental health problems seem to become. So I think, I ask myself, is there a causal relationship between the two? And I think there is, and I think that one of the reasons why a lot of problems have kicked in education is because they've been internally generated, rather than necessarily because the children coming to classes have got greater psychological deficits than in the past.
Can I just clarify, is your difficulty with circle time the kind of topics that are discussed, or is it with circle time per se? And the reason I'm asking that is because you say that children discuss things among themselves naturally, but one of the things we find is that children from certain home backgrounds actually don't get a chance to discuss, you know, more higher order topics and to use kind of a broad range of language. And maybe it's benefiting those children to actually talk with their peers in a circle.
I think that if circle time was focused on high order topics, I would have no problems with it. I use a method of teaching in seminars at university level where basically I throw out a problem and I sometimes just go out of the room for 20 minutes and I let people discuss those kinds of things. But I assume that my students are not discussing their feelings about what makes them feel good and bad, but they're discussing the content, the ambiguities of the problems that I've set for them. And I think that's all right, but that's not what circle time is. Circle time has got a quite self-conscious, therapeutic focus, rather than one that's to do with, it's about teaching what they call soft skills, rather than about teaching a discipline or about anything to do with intellectual content or knowledge content.
What's your view of child-centered education?
Well, I think child-centered education is a charade. It's very dishonest. It's what Bernstein used to call the hidden curriculum. And I think it's dishonest principally because, it invites, as its opposite, adult-centered education, right? I don't think very many teachers in the world are saying, oh, I'm an adult-centered teacher. It doesn't make any sense at all. I think what a child-centered education does is it tries to create the impression that they're doing something that is very, very different and very rare to what has gone on beforehand. And what they're doing, in a sense, is they're recycling through the, sort of the symbol of a child, what are adult concerned and an adult agenda. I think a proper education is not child-centered and it's not adult-centered. It's centered on the subject, and it's based upon a relationship between adult and child. And I think it's the relational attitude towards education, where it's not the child that determines what you teach, it's not the adult that determines what you teach, but the needs of the content of that discipline, the knowledge that you have to impart that determines what you teach. Because at that particular moment, the obvious next lesson is going to be based on a particular development of the subject. I think that's the way to go forward, and therefore I think I would opt for a knowledge-based education where the child and the adults work together in a relational way that is continually evolving, and the relationship will change quite dramatically by the time the child is 16 or 17, because at that point you kind of have succeeded in educating that child for independence and for the exercise of choice and for freedom.
And what's your view of parent-school partnerships?
I'm not a fan. I think that parents should stay in the home and schools should distance themselves from parents. I think that one of the worst consequences of parent involvement is that it distracts teachers from teaching. I mean, one of the most horrific things in parent-teacher's evenings or in the interaction is the way in which parents are almost incited to act as these monitors and who subvert the role of the teachers. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about is that it's led to a situation where parents feel that they got the authority to make judgments on teachers in a way that's very, very unhelpful, and where parents freely criticize teachers in front of their children, forgetting that if you devalue a teacher in the eyes of your child, you're making it very difficult for that teacher to ever be effective because you now have the parents' permission to disrespect them. I think that parental involvement in schools has really had a very disorienting, corrosive effect, and it's not the parents' fault. It's not that they kind of woke up in the morning and decided to subvert education. It's because of their in the way in which they've been made to feel both insecure and then drawn into something that is none of their affair.
Could you say a little bit about what you call the education equality trade-off?
The education equality trade-off is based upon the idea that the central feature of education ought to be an attempt to create greater equality, to be more inclusive. It's a kind of social engineering impulse whereby the idea is that if you lower the barriers a little bit, or if you focus on everybody in the same kind of a way, then you may well not kind of provide the most challenging educational environment, but at least there will be more equality and everybody will be better off as a result of that. But the problem with this idea is, the idea of inclusion in this kind of sense raises the question of inclusion into what? And very often it's to an inferior form of education where you end up patronizing usually working class or immigrant children by not taking them seriously, by setting them goals that are relatively easy to attain. And although you think you're making them feel good, you don't actually make them more equal, nor do you make them feel good, because they know deep inside that they've been cheated to some extent. They can tell there's a difference between the quality education that some other schools provide for more prosperous families. So I think in that sense, you know, sort of I go back to the old Gramscian idea that what you really want to do is to provide the most sophisticated, the most challenging education, the best there is, you know, in terms of classical education, but for an ever-widening section of society.
So for children who are struggling in the education system, and who, you know, maybe are finding it difficult to read or finding it difficult to grasp ideas, how should a teacher respond to those students in a way that is still educational?
Well, I think it should be entirely educational. We're not talking about primary education, presumably. And I think at primary schools...
Well, we could be talking about primary as well.
Well, I think in primary education, you cannot give up on anybody. And you have to find different ways of compensating for the fact that some people are struggling by either providing more intensive teaching, by providing sort of resources after school. I mean, there's a number of different ways that can be done. I happen to think that good teachers are a solution. And one of my friends used to pride herself in the fact that she could literally teach any child to read. I mean, all these people that were put in special needs and everything else, she would come around and in 2-3 months they were reading. So it wasn't like beyond the realm of possibilities. I mean, to teach kids how to read is not a kind of an impossible task. So it seems to me that in primary education, we've got to find ways of ensuring that everybody has an opportunity to really find their voice in the education system, and that they get to the point where, you know, sort of they may well not be as good learners as some of the other kids, but they certainly have got to the point where the foundation for literacy and for mathematics and for basic education has been laid. I think that obviously, you know, when you then move on, you are going to have more differentiated reactions. And I think what's very important is to make sure is that no matter what kind of education you're providing, and I think that there's an argument for providing some children with vocational education as opposed to a strictly academic education, you do make sure that even vocational education has got a significant knowledge-based content, that it isn't just simply a question of giving up on their education. I think they still need to be educated, but they need to be educated in a different kind of way.
Because you're critical as well of the idea of multiple intelligence.
Totally, yes, totally.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, I think that, you know, sort of obviously, you know, you and I are sitting here, and no doubt you're probably a better singer than I am, you're maybe more tactile than I am. I may well have, you know, sort of different kinetic skills than you have. You know, we're all different, and we have very different dispositions. And I think what has happened is that as a way of bypassing the problem of how you teach a common curriculum, we have the multiple intelligence theories developed, you know, where we try to, you know, sort of, in a sense, the effect of it is to devalue intellectual education by equating it to everything else. And it seems to me that whilst recognizing that young people are very, very different from one another. And whilst recognizing that some people's talents, you know, will vary and it's heterogeneous, we nevertheless insist that we all teach them to a common curriculum, so that there's a foundation, a common foundation, which is part of their generational heritage, on which their specific talents can evolve and flourish. And as long as we do that, I don't particularly mind if you then go off and cultivate your athletic skills and somebody else cultivates their artistic skills. That's totally all right by me, as long as that foundation has been laid in the first place.
So it's an optional extra, these different intelligences, rather than being core to the education process.
I wouldn't call them intelligences, I call them dispositions. I think that there is only one kind of intelligence, and the very pluralization of intelligence in the world that we live in, where emotional intelligence is seen to be the equivalent of academic intelligence, and there's other kind of, you know, computing intelligence, all these things proliferate. They only have one purpose, which is to say that academic learning is overrated, that the acquisition of knowledge is no big deal. And I think that as a result of that, they have a very corrosive impact. We used to call emotional intelligence sensitivity, and yes, you know, we used to call other kind of intelligence as being artistic minded, you know, but their disposition then to kind of elevate them into comparable intelligences, I think is a very Philistine orientation towards culture and our intellectual legacy.
So when you're talking about the true intelligence, then, can you just outline what that is?
It's the intelligence that's based upon our capacity to learn, to assimilate knowledge, to interpret that knowledge. It's our capacity to select and compare and to abstract and to theorize and to conceptualize. I mean, all those things are kind of really bound up with it. Now, obviously, you know, within that range of activities, some of us are better than others. I, as somebody who's drawn towards facts, may not be as good as you are, who are drawn towards theorizing. Nevertheless, you know, we're talking the same kind of language. We're talking different ways of kind of communicating the legacy of the past, assimilating it, and re-representing it in a new form. That's all very different than, you know, what are other accomplishments that we as human beings have, from being sensitive to one another, to being open to new experiences, to being artistic, or to be able to sing well. I mean, all these things are dispositions that we have to a greater or lesser extent.
And that was Frank Faraday, the author of Wasted, Why Education is Not Educating, talking about the one true intelligence and bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll have more from Frank Faraday on next week's programme. You can listen to podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest Frank Faraday, and until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.